Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Julia Gillard, and this is a podcast of one's own. Hello, listeners. Happy New Year. Thanks for joining me for this special bonus episode of A Podcast of One's Own. Some of you may know I am an honorary professor at the University of Adelaide and usually have the pleasure of delivering an annual public lecture in my hometown. But these have been different times for all of us, and in a COVID world, of course, a lecture was not possible. So instead, I recorded a panel with three remarkable Australian women, all University of Adelaide alumni like myself. They are Professor Tanya Munro, Australia's Chief Defence Scientist and the first woman in that position, the Honourable Amanda Vanstone, former Australian Senator with numerous cabinet positions including Minister for Immigration and former Australian Ambassador to Italy, and Frances Adamson, first woman in the role of Secretary of Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. These are women who have reached the top of their fields and broken gender barriers along the way. I found it a fascinating discussion, and I'm sure you will too. Today, I'm going to ask you all to share some background to your lives and careers, your experiences of gender, and the things that you have learned along the way. First, thanks for joining me in this COVID-modified fashion. It's obviously a very difficult time for so many people across Australia and the world still. Frances, you head up a huge government department with offices and staff scattered across the globe. Can you tell us a bit about what your work has been like over the past 6 months and how it's changed from normal?
Very happy to, Julia, and I'm very conscious that I speak in a way about staff across the globe in a network of over 100 posts, some of whom have been doing it very, very tough indeed during this period. But in terms of our overseas network, they've geared up completely to trying to help Australians and help Australians return, and they've managed to do that. There have been hundreds of thousands of Australians actually who've returned, many of them under their own steam. But our heads of mission and my colleagues around the globe have really helped enable Australians to access flights. There are still ongoing difficulties with that, of course, and that relates in part to the need for quarantine and caps in Australia to keep Australians safe here. But we've also had colleagues out purchasing PPE for Australians, gloves and masks and ventilators, and that work has largely gone unsung, but it's been very important. We've had input into domestic Australian policy as we've learnt lessons about the spread of COVID and how to contain it from our network of posts overseas. And here in Australia, of course, our staff, like much of the Australian public service, has principally been working remotely. At one point, I think 80% of our staff were, and we had 80% working one way or another on COVID through our 24-hour consular operations centre, our crisis centre, taking literally, I think we've now taken close to 100,000 phone calls from Australians. Our heads of mission have managed to lift their game on social media, and they've got millions of likes and views, and that they've become much more popular, I would venture to say, than they once were. But we feel as if we've been in the thick of it. My colleagues have lifted enormously. They've done amazing work, much of it unsung, including while normal things happen in the world, even abnormal normal things. And here I'm thinking of colleagues in Beirut with that big explosion recently and all that they've done to assist Australians as well. So a remarkable period of time. We're not through it yet. We've adapted a lot. We've learnt a lot. We've all learnt a lot, including about leadership, and I'm sure we'll come to that.
Well, we're all thankful for that very hard work. Amanda, what's life been like for you? Full of Zoom fatigue?
It's been great, actually. As you know, if you do things in the community in Australia, a lot of it is on the eastern seaboard. And if you're from Adelaide, the flights aren't that great. So it's a longer haul than the people from Melbourne and Sydney who meet. So meeting them by Zoom has been fantastic. It's been really good. There's been a certain pleasure in greeting them and saying, you know, in Adelaide we can go out and go to a restaurant and enjoy ourselves. Much as you'd like to condemn us, we're doing very well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed that aspect of it. Less travel has been really good, and I don't mind a bit of time to myself. So I've found it pretty good, actually. The ABC, for whom I do a Radio National program, the techs have been fantastic. They came and set me up at home. There were a few bumps and widgets and things to sort out, but we've got it sorted out. And I actually find it is clearly, at an intellectual level, ridiculous that I now feel closer to my producer and the person I'm interviewing, because I think mentally there's only three of us there, or her, the tech in Sydney, and the person I'm interviewing. But if I go into the studio, as I used to, it's like you're part of a big swimming pool of people. And somehow I feel more connected to the people I'm interviewing that way, doing it from home. I don't know why.
That's really interesting. I've been doing all sorts of Zooms and link-ups around the world in global time zones, so often they're not that hospitable to Adelaide life. So I've been on meetings at, you know, 2 a.m. Yeah. Into New York and stuff like that. But there is an intimacy to that medium. I agree with you about that. Tanya, how have you found it?
I found it quite refreshing on the whole, because for me, what this new way of working means is that about the half the time I'm working from home, talking to colleagues around the nation, using video conferencing of various kinds, and I've found it's actually been easier to get inclusion and to shape people who might be quite introverted, their contribution through those means than it is just from physical meetings. Although I'd acknowledge if you do a lot of video conferencing, it's more draining than being in person. It takes more out of you and you've got to pace yourself differently. And of course, working in defence, there's some things that you can only do on site. So I spend quite a bit of time at the Russell Complex doing things that you can't do at home. But I like that blend. For me, more than half of our defence scientists are in Adelaide. And so we've had to get really good at breaking down any barriers to communication without being able to eyeball people. So I've started sending out video messages, and I find I get better response from colleagues when they can see you rather than just reading an email. So that's been refreshing.
It is interesting in a time where there's so much despair and gloom around that we are learning some new strategies that we can take with us in a post-pandemic era and have a different approach to working life. From the point of view of Beyond Blue, I chair Beyond Blue, and we are seeing absolutely record demand. So many people are finding this as a time of stress and loneliness and anxiety, and yet we are learning new things, as each of us is finding. I want to move the conversation now back in time, if I can. I want to take each of you back to some of the things that formed you and your life's journey and your leadership. Amanda, I'd like to start with you. You were a lawyer before entering politics. What inspired you to make that big leap into Parliament?
Well, I was a baby lawyer because I actually went to work for Myers when I left school. I wanted to be a buyer, and I loved working there. I learnt as much working for them as I did doing an arts degree, maybe not a law degree, but certainly as much as doing an arts degree. And they were, to be fair, they were great employers, gave me time off to start studying and, you know, that sort of thing. You do learn a lot. You learn to be very practical when you have a real job. And you also learn that parents of friends you went to school with who know you quite well might not recognise you that clearly if you're in a black dress behind a counter. So there was a lot to learn there, but I progressed through from a marketing studies certificate at the Institute of Technology, now UniSA, and decided to do an arts degree and then shifted into law as well. And so I wasn't... And I was doing that part-time. I put myself through part-time. typical story, first person in my family to go to university. And I was a Liberal. I knew, for a simple reason in my view, that if you don't support the people making money, there won't be money to do good things like schools, whatever. But I was so annoyed with them. I mean, they just talked old-fashioned, stuffy old language. Men in pinstripe three-piece suits with gold fob chains talking to each other. I thought, these people are never going to win government. They're never going to get there in the state. This is hopeless. And someone said, why don't you have a go? So that's how it started.
And these stuffy old men in the Liberal Party, what was their initial reaction to you? Was it,
You know the answer to that. They did not warm to me. It took a fair while, but, you know, my guardian angel, who sometimes I think, you fly low and I'm grabbing you by the wings, sister, and you're coming down and getting a slap. We're having a new enterprise bargaining agreement with you. She doesn't always look after me, but she did when I stood for state parliament a few times. She put the wing down and said, no, you're not going there. You're not going there. So it took a while. It took a while.
But you got there. Tanya, turning to you, you've said that as a child you had originally aspired to be a musician, but you went on to complete a PhD in photonics. I'm hoping I said that right. And by the time you were 25 years old, you had that PhD in your hand. So what made you change from music to that part of science?
It was really two things for me, Julia. One was an amazing physics teacher, and just about everybody I know who's gone on to do science can point at a teacher somewhere who made a difference for them. I could suddenly see that maths, which I'd always loved, was the language of the universe, and you could use it to ask amazing, inspiring questions like, you know, why is the universe expanding, and all sorts of things that kids get excited about. That was one. It was also the realisation that science is creative, that it's not about following dull procedures, but it's about curiosity and asking questions and finding out things nobody may have discovered before, and that's intoxicating. And then when I was between year 11 and 12, I went along to what's now called the National Youth Science Forum, which I'm now the very proud science patron of. And I got a chance to meet other people like me, and I knew that I'd made the right choice at that point.
And that physics teacher who was so inspiring, was that a man or a woman? And what was the mix of boys and girls in the class?
That physics teacher who was so wonderfully inspiring was a man with a very strong Scottish accent, so I still hear physics in Scots in my head. But when I reflect on my teaching, I didn't have a female lecturer in physics at undergraduate. So my first time coming across female tuition teaching was as a peer when I became a professor of physics at the University of Adelaide. So really it was a very male path. For me at school, I happened to be on a music scholarship at an all-girls school, so gender didn't really come into my mind in those early days for me in discovering science. But it did when I got to university, and how it hit me was confidence. I met this wonderful bunch of friends who are still friends to this day, but I remember so viscerally coming out of exams and thinking, oh, I'm not sure how that went, and having pretty much all my male friends say, rocked that. And, you know, I'd have to say that the results didn't tally up to the confidence, but at that point, comparing my own confidence, I questioned whether I was in the right space. So I think a confidence gap is something that many girls feel.
Given the PhD, I bet you can say now in retrospect you did rock those exams. Frances, what do you enjoy about the public service and what attracted you to it, and in particular to foreign affairs?
Well, Julia, there are three parts to the question, I think. But I think the first thing to say is, and with no disrespect to either of you, my mother, Jennifer Cashmore, was a state politician. So I'd grown up seeing what politicians did up close and personal, if you like, and I was very taken with the level of service that goes into servicing members of or constituents to people who live in your electorate. I decided that wasn't for me, but I was very much attracted to the idea of public service, and that was in part, I suppose, because I felt I'd been very fortunate in life and a good education, and part of that good education was at the University of Adelaide, and of course it was at a time when there were no fees, and I remember one of the very few times I've been out on the streets demonstrating in my life, I think, was a demonstration you organised, Julia, and that was against the introduction of university fees. So, but I had been fortunate, and I also had a sense, a proud sense of being a South Australian, as many people who grew up in the state had. The foreign affairs part of it, though, I was fortunate enough to break my first year of university studies to go overseas on a student exchange program, AFS, to the Netherlands. And that really just opened my eyes to what was going on in the world then strategically, the USSR and the stationing of missiles in Europe that was a deep concern to, obviously, to the Netherlands and to Germany next door. So I was really sort of awakened by all of that. And then, you know, the public service then had a way of attracting would-be economist graduates, and my eyes were open to the fact that Canberra was a pretty reasonable place. But what do I still enjoy about that? 35 years on, it genuinely is serving the public and working in the national interest. And I think the Australian public has every right to demand high-quality services and very strong delivery from not just elected members of parliament, ministers and the prime minister, but from public servants as well.
I think we just need to come crystal clear on the Adelaide Uni connection here. So I first came to the University of Adelaide in 1979. Amanda, when were you here?
Oh, very long time. If you do a law arts degree part-time, you're very familiar with the university. So somewhere in the early 70s till the early 80s.
Frances, what year were you here?
Julia, well, I started in 79 too in the law and economics. I had a couple of years travelling in the middle of that one as an exchange student, and I graduated in 1985 with an economics degree, having flirted with the idea of going to Roseworthy and becoming a winemaker, but foreign affairs called. So we did, in fact, overlap, I think, for a couple of years when you were there.
We most certainly did, and maybe in your future some winemaking might lie in the years beyond the public service. Tanya, when were you at the University of Adelaide?
Well, actually, my undergrad and PhD was at the University of Sydney, and I came first to the University of Adelaide in 2005 as the first female professor of physics, and spent 10 very productive and happy years there growing photonics research at the university.
Fantastic. Now, I want to talk to each of you about some of your early experiences with gender. I have co-authored a book with a great friend of mine, Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala, and it's on women and leadership. And we interviewed 8 women leaders around the world, and we asked each of them what was the first time that they recall being treated differently because they were a girl, and how did they respond to that? So, Tanya, can I put that question to you?
Thank you, Julia. It's actually interesting, reflecting back, I didn't feel it as a girl. I felt it first as a woman at university. And the little anecdote I'll tell you really is one that tells it most strongly. It wasn't till the end of my undergraduate degree, and I was looking at where I might do my PhD. And I started looking at other universities, areas that interested me, and I went and visited a professor doing something I thought was fascinating. To be told that I wasn't the calibre of student that did that kind of work. And it was as I was walking out of the building trying to hold back tears that I realised he'd not actually looked at my CV. That's when I realised I was being treated differently. And when I went on to win the Bragg Gold Medal for the best physics PhD in Australia in that year, I did wonder if he'd noticed. So that was the first time I noticed being treated differently. And I'm glad it wasn't when I was younger, because I think it might have dented my confidence more.
And you resisted the temptation to go back with the medal in your hand and go, look at this, buddy.
I did, but, you know, I still secretly hope he did notice.
You're a politer woman than I am. Amanda?
I don't think it was the first, but there were three girls in my house, and my brother and my mother. So it was a predominantly female household. I went to an all-girls school, so I didn't have that kind of thing early on. But I do remember one in Parliament that still aggravates me, actually. It was when there was going to be a referendum in the 1980s, and there were four questions, and one was about fair elections, one vote, one value. And if you couldn't have that type of election because you had some different set up in states like Tasmania, it had to be as close as possible to the Senate election. So we have a look at the bill. I'm a sort of nobody, a new person in, and a girl, and there weren't that many of them at that time in the early 80s. And I went to Fred Cheney and to Richard Olson and a bunch of these people and said, maybe not Richard, Fred and others, and said, look, they can't do this. They've got a bill for the ACT that doesn't elect people in the same way as the Senate does. So one of these has to go. And they said, oh, thanks very much, and just ignored it. So I went back a few days later and said, look, have you done anything about that? You know, they're going to have to change one of these. So it's the time to pounce and say they're an incompetent bunch of jerks. No, no, no. And it just, I mean, maybe I was incompetent in not getting them to understand, but it was pretty clear, plain English stuff. And then one day Austin Lewis came running in and said, pointed at me and said, she's right. They're going to withdraw one of the fair election bills and amend it. And then there was a huge fracas, and guess who got to speak in the debate? Fred Cheney, Austin Lewis and Chris Bublik, who were responsible for electoral matters, not the person who'd actually spotted it and thought of it. And that had to be. That had to be because they thought she's just a new dumb girl.
In doing this book with Ngozi, we talk to women who'd served as presidents and prime ministers, and what's interesting to me is even at the level of president, women talked about having their ideas overlooked, and then when a man pointed it out, people going, that's genius, so clearly that's what happened to you. Frances, what about your earliest recollection of being treated differently simply because you were a woman or girl?
Thanks, Julia. And can I, though, I mean, we're not being encouraged to recommend your book, but I've almost finished it. I think I'm up to page 282, and I met Ngozi in Washington with Maurice Payne 3 weeks ago, and it's a really fabulous book, and it just shows how you can think differently about these things over a period of time. And I think, you know, your hypotheses, I won't talk through them, let the cat out of the bag, but strongly recommend them to men and women listening to this. Look, Mike, the first thing when I think about this is an interesting question. I've got to go back, must be close to 53 or 4 years, and it was to a work Christmas party that I went to with my father. It was his work. He was working for what was then Hills Industries. And, you know, there was a Father Christmas there. I suppose I was about 5 or 6, and the gifts were handed out, and I got a doll. And I felt hugely disappointed when I saw this doll and saw what the boys were getting. I can't even remember what it was now, but it was something much more interesting. And I thought to myself, why do I have to have this when I don't want it, when the boys have got something that's much better? Now, that's a really – it's a small idea, but it was quite powerful over the years in just having me develop a sense of perhaps somewhat righteous indignation, not always the best thing for a diplomat. In my family, I mean, both parents, Jennifer Cashmore and Ian Adamson, were very strongly supportive. You know, there wasn't anything that their children couldn't achieve if they wanted to. But I remember when I applied for DFAT, I asked a University of Adelaide tutor, a wonderful man, if he would write me a reference, and he said, yes, of course I will, but, you know, you won't get in. And the implication being, you know, they don't take many women. Well, fortunately, the Sex Discrimination Act, as you all know, was passed in 1984. That obliged DFAT to change its recruitment practices. And I was one of 14 women and 12 men, the very first time there'd ever been more women than men recruited into DFAT in 1985. So lots more stories beyond that, but it just shows how the grain of an idea or a thought from a very young age can be quite powerful over decades.
Absolutely, and those early influences matter so much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Amanda, you once said, and I love this quote, the truest test of equality is whether, if you think of the least effective man in a job, an equally ineffective woman could get that job. When are we going to get there, and what do we need to do to remove the barriers that are stopping women coming through?
Well, look, we've got a long way to go because, look, I understand it is true. Women with skills and with education will still face some barriers. I get that. But they're more likely to get ahead. They've got better chances. And then you look at some boofhead that's got a job. In politics, you see a few of them, as you know, on both sides. And you think, well, what's going on here? How come that dork got that job? Why can't we have a dork woman in that job? And that's the real test. And I feel that a bit with some things like Me Too as well. You know, if you're a celebrity or you're in a very powerful position, Me Too will be very helpful to you. I haven't seen them doing much about women on the shop floor. So I think we need to look at equality, yes, at the top because it serves as an example and all of those things are true. But I think we need to have a bit of focus on the bottom as well.
And what would you recommend we could do for women at all levels? I agree with you that, you know, feminism and equality needs to be for women no matter where they are in living, who they are, their occupation. But how do we achieve that? What would you do if you had a magic wand?
Look, I think the magic wand, apparently the Jesuits say you've got to get them when they're young. And I feel a bit that way too. I mean, I don't think making university free, in fact, I know it didn't make much of a change because lots of people got scholarships anyway, and all you did was pay for rich people's kids to come to university. So I think get them when they're young. You get the kids in primary school to start thinking of themselves as someone who could be a Tanya Munro or a Frances Adamson. Get the girls when they're young and give them the confidence then. It's too late to say it in year 12 or when they're at university. It's never too late, but that's what I do. Focus on the young kids. Get them when they're little.
And thinking about your own career, there must have been lots and lots of times when you were the only woman in a room.
Plenty.
And looking back on that now, how did you experience it? Was it a disadvantage or from time to time was it an advantage because you stood out so much?
It can be an advantage. In politics especially, some men will stupidly sort of abrogate the policies that might be particularly affect women, take less interest and say, well, what do you say about this? So you get the floor. But I thought the most effective and fun thing to do, if you couldn't break into the table because you're the only woman there, is just to sigh and say something like, oh, there's far too much testosterone here. And, of course, then they all start thinking of their personal bits. Why is she talking about that? And for 30 seconds, there's a gap while they're wondering why you've said that, and you can get in and get the agenda. And it works. I guarantee you it works.
OK, Frances, is that a strategy for the Department of Foreign Affairs?
I was just thinking I should add it to my toolkit, actually.
But you have thought a lot about your women and leadership strategy in foreign affairs, and how important do you think that is, and what's different about achieving gender equality in the foreign affairs area compared with other bits of the public service?
Well, I think it was a long time coming, if you like. I mean, I said in 85 when I started, I thought I was joining a department which was literally gender equal and a whole range of things would just flow from that. And I went off on overseas postings and made a career in China and had a family and remained interested. But I, at a certain point, I looked and I thought that the promise of, you know, 30 years ago, it hasn't really been delivered. And there were plenty of women in the department who had reached a sort of similar conclusion, I suppose, and unbeknownst to me in Beijing were actually sort of agitating. And they didn't need to agitate really, because Peter Varghese's secretary was very open to the development of a women in leadership strategy, which was done very collaboratively and inclusively as these things need to be, and with some very valuable help from Liz Broderick and others too. But so when I became secretary 4 years ago, I inherited some targets and I inherited quite a lot of work and I inherited some progress, but I also inherited a degree of scepticism and some pushback and what I would now call, looking back, an early phase of this really sort of catching on. And I think 4 years on, We've now got, I think the latest figures I was given last week, 44% of our career-appointed heads of mission overseas are women. When I started, it was around about 25, I think, and these are all decisions ultimately taken by the foreign minister and the prime minister, but you need to create an environment where women feel that they can put themselves forward for these roles. It's not all about serving overseas. We can have diplomats who represent Australia in multilateral negotiations or even just, here in Canberra around the country. But we thought it was important, and I still do, that the Foreign Service, if you like, and this department be broadly representative of the Australian population in all of its diversity, including our culturally and linguistically diverse diversity as well. So I think, looking at the department today, and I'm just struck, I think we are, we've always been a pretty respectful place, but I think the nature of the conversations are different. I think it is much more inclusive. I think during the COVID time, as Tanya said, and as you did too, Julia, the connections between people, in fact, we're all agreed on this. I think life is just more personal, and we are connected not just in ways where there's a professional barrier between home and work. I think people are seen more in the round as individuals, and I think we've been able to achieve some great things during this period, in part because we're able to draw on the full talent of our workforce, and we don't have people putting themselves on the sideline or on the bench because expected behaviours or expected time commitment means that they can't make it all work. So I think it's definitely a work in progress, and these things take years, and I think we'd all recognise now they take decades and the work is never done. But I'm really proud of what we've achieved as a department, and my younger colleagues coming through, men and women, whatever their backgrounds, for all of them, you can't be what you can't see. There's plenty to see in DFAT and in diplomacy for Australia.
That's fantastic to hear. Tanya, I'm going to take you to Amanda's statements about all of this starts young. And one of the things that we know starts young is the low participation rates of girls in STEM, in science, technology, engineering, maths style studies compared to boys. Are there key strategies you would put in place at different ages, primary school, high school, university, mid-career, to make a difference to that gender skew?
Julia, absolutely, and I think a lot about this. So starting with primary school, there's no question that if you talk to any kid at primary school, you can stir an excitement, an interest, a curiosity in science, whether that's space, whether that's dinosaurs, there's something you can get them fired up and excited about. And I think one thing we need to do is look at our teaching training systems and make sure that people don't end up choosing to be primary school teachers because of a lack of confidence in science and maths. I think that's an important consideration. But the first thing around the primary school age is harnessing that joy and curiosity that doesn't at that age see what might be difficulty or challenge. South Australia's actually been a real pioneer in that, because while I was the chair of the National Youth Science Forum, which I mentioned earlier, we set up a pilot in South Australia of something called the STEM Explorer for year 6 and 7 kids, all from government schools taken from across the state, brought together for a week and given the chance to see science outside the school context while they were still young enough to remember that enthusiasm and joy for science. I think that's critical. Then at high school, I think the key is exposing kids to science and how it applies to the world, because they're at an age where they're starting to care deeply. I have 3 teenage sons, and, for them, seeing how science impacts environmental concerns, seeing how science is driving space exploration, all of these things excite them in a way that science in school rarely does unless you've got the gift of an extraordinary teacher. And we need, again, to back our teachers and support them getting a depth of expertise that gives them the confidence to challenge the kids. Then at university, I think it's particularly about confidence, and Amanda and I have both touched on that confidence for girls and women, because we have, some extraordinary girls coming into that system, and we need them to realise that they can make a difference and that that diversity of thinking means you get better science done. Now, when we think about what happens further out in careers, I think we have a serious structural problem with science in Australia. So much of our science workforce is on short contracts, contract to contract, and that particularly affects women. And it's incredibly hard to get an on-ramp back on. When I was at UniSA, I set up a scheme to help invest in women who are off on maternity leave so that when they came back from a break, they could get on without having to start from a still stop. But there's so much more we need to do. Look, I'm encouraged by the fact that at Defence Science and Technology Group, we bring in amazing men and women at the graduate and the cadet stage. But we do have to address the fact that more of the women leave as you get further through careers. I think we have to do that by holding organisations to account. The SAGE initiative across Australia has required our universities and publicly funded research organisations to take a cold, hard look at their data about retention, recruitment, promotion, and hold themselves to account for initiatives that will help change that. And I think by those differentiated strategies at every stage, what we can do is not just put girls and women in the pipeline for STEM, but address some of the leaks in that pipeline.
Maybe we're growing up a generation that'll all want to be infectious diseases scientists, inspired by growing up in the COVID pandemic.
I hope so.
Frances used the expression, you can't be what you can't see. And one of the things that my co-author Ngozi and I looked at when we wrote our book was about role modelling. And we found that if a woman leader was too positive and glossed over the difficult parts of their careers, women simply didn't believe them, or they might conclude that they were superheroes and that they could never be like that themselves. But if a woman was too negative about her experiences, it would put other women off. So it's a difficult conundrum. You've got to land somewhere between putting a gloss on it and making it all sound too hard. Against that backdrop, you know, who's been important to you, to each of you, as role models throughout your careers? And how do you feel about being a role model yourself? How do you live that? Amanda, can I start with you?
I think for me, I would say Roma Mitchell. She was a friend of my first stepfather's, and she sort of stayed connected with us after he died. We used to call my mother the Merry Widow, but, you know, that's another story. Anyway, Roma was great, and for some reason we had some sort of connection. And I can remember talking to her once when she was chair of the parole board, and everyone was, I mean, it's fair to say there was a you-know-what storm going on because someone had been let out on parole. And we were having conversation over dinner because I'd have dinner with her every now and then. And she said, look, you've got to bear in mind if you're the chair of something, you have to go with the majority and that's it. And I thought, well, that sounds a bit rough. But later when I was thinking of doing a book and I'd started, because the years in opposition were incredibly boring, Julia, when your people were constantly in power for 10 or 11 years, and it was going to be called Portia's People, people who'd done law and gone on to do other things. So Roma was an ideal candidate. Interview her, what does she say? A collection of these women would be. And when I went in, she was in Government House, and I said, righto, now what's your advice? This is to a 9 to 12-year-old girl. We want to set them going. What is your advice? Do you know what it was? Don't fret.
Oh.
I said, Roma, you've got to have more than that. She said, I don't think so. If you have confidence in yourself and you don't fret, you know, you fix what you can fix and move on. And, you know, I think that's largely right. There's no point in worrying. Worrying doesn't solve anything. It just makes you feel bad.
Don't fret. I like.
Don't fret. I mean, from such a talented woman, and probably that's why she was able to give you such, well, me, such short and concise advice.
I think that's powerful. Don't fret. Tanya, what would you say?
So look, for me, as I shared with you earlier, I didn't see a lot of women in my line of work really till I got to the UK after my PhD. And I remember someone who inspired me and served as a role model was Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who discovered the first pulsars. And hearing her tell her stories about how hard it was for her at the time to make that breakthrough known and accepted in the community. I have to say, when I'm acting as a role model myself, I've had to get past feeling uncomfortable about that, and I've had to realise that actually what makes the biggest impact is actually talking about some of the times that have been most challenging for me, which without doubt was when I had three children under three, premature twins who had a lot of reflux issues and was running a research group at the University of Adelaide. So for me, that period of time really taught me how to prioritise, how to delegate and a whole lot of things. Sharing that with warts and all, I found to be a real icebreaker in trying to talk to young women.
Wow. And how did young women react when you shared those stories? Do you think they took heart that you can balance work and family life, you can come through, that you can look at your career in periods and it's not always going to be as difficult as it was when you had three kids under three? Was that the reaction, or did you get some who were, I could never have got myself through that, I couldn't be like you?
I think it's a bit of a mix and you've got to be careful how you use it. But I think that the conversation about what really matters, how you prioritise and how you just adjust to different stages of life is a really powerful one.
Thank you. And Frances?
Look, I look back, no single mentor, a whole range of inspiring people along the way. But picking up a point that Tanya's just made, really, I think one of the things that's really been most important to me is good advice, often just very well grounded, from either people I've been working with, family members. Obviously, mothers are hugely important in this respect, and so are partners. And my husband, Rod, has always given me good advice. But if I look back, there would have been half a dozen times where if I hadn't got good advice or people hadn't been prepared to cut me a bit of slack. You know, I didn't have three under three. I had four under 10, but it was still a sort of a heavy-ish load, I've got to say, at a demanding time. If those people hadn't small acts of kindness or practical advice, I would not have stayed in the game. So I think there's a lot to be said about mentoring, but there's also a lot to be said for people who feel that mentoring is such a big commitment and they can't take it on. I think when you do help people, when you're in a position to do so in whatever role you are, and it can be a really small thing, but I think we sometimes underestimate just how powerful those small acts, often of flexibility, can be. And that's something I've really tried to do here in the department, and just the informal feedback I get is it's really helpful to men and to women as well. So I'd come at it from a slightly different perspective, but I'm also pleased to say at the moment I've only 6 months ago, for the first time in my life, I've actually got a formal mentor, and her name is Lisa Anise, and she's mentoring me as the department's diversity champion. And I was pretty confident I knew what to do about women in leadership, but broader diversity, I've needed some practical suggestions, and it's great to have Lisa by my side as I do my job as Secretary and Diversity and Inclusion Champion.
That's fantastic to hear. Now, we talked earlier about the way we're all living this COVID pandemic period and some of the opportunities that we've found in it. But we do know right around Australia that there are people struggling with lockdowns, with economic loss, with the uncertainty about how the world is going to emerge from all of this. So I'm going to ask each of you to share a message of hope and support for people who are finding this a very difficult period in their lives. Amanda, what would you say?
This will pass.
Not a word wasted. This will pass.
Learnt from Roma.
That's right. Don't fret. Tanya.
Look, it's hard to beat this will pass, but what I'll say is that organisations the world over are reflecting on how they need to change as a result of this. So I would say just think about the change you want to make and how you want to be part of that, because I think there'll be very different opportunities post this. So there's a case for hope.
Frances.
And I'd just add, I think we will emerge from this stronger. Australians are very pragmatic, resilient people. We're willing to learn lessons as we go. We've got a great sense of community, and we're in a part of the world that really needs us to be at our best. So I am
optimistic. We will come through this and we will be the better for it.
And that is a great note to draw our conversation to a conclusion on. Can I thank each of you, women connected with Adelaide University in various ways, for participating in what's been a delightful discussion. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Julia.
You've been listening to a podcast of One's Own with Julia Gillard from the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at King's College London. If you want to learn more about our work, visit the Global Institute for Women's Leadership website and sign up to our updates. This podcast has been produced by Connie Blafari and James Miller with King's Online, with editing by Nick Hilton. If you liked what you've been listening to, we'd love it if you could rate and review us with your preferred podcast provider. We're always looking for feedback and it really helps people to learn more about our work. And please join us next time for another episode of A Podcast of One's Own.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.